Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by one of our favorite guests, Tom Nichols, Radio Free Tom, who describes himself as professor, author on Russia, war, nukes, author of the book of, The Death of Expertise, noted curmudgeon, anti-populist, ex-GOP cat guy. See, this is the second day in a row that I have a cat person on this show, this podcast.
We're everywhere, Charlie. But we're everywhere.
Sarah Longwell put out a tweet saying that I insulted her cats, which is not true. Actually, what I did was I said, who are the worst people in the world? Never throners or cat people. And I think that's an unresolved question. So this is not an insult to the cat. It's the question about, you know, cat people and can you ever trust cat people? And I think we know the answer to that.
Like cats, we're quiet, we're sneaky, and you know, you never see us coming.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So we're all marking time waiting for the Mueller report to come out on Thursday morning, and everyone's head will explode. And of course, you know, even though we've kind of been through this before, does it feel a little bit of deja vu where you get that all the pundits and the talking heads are ramping up the expectations? And look, our advice of the Bulwark is, look, guys, we want this release. We want maximum transparency, but everybody ought to read it. Read the whole thing before giving us your hot takes and assuming that somehow this thing's going to drop at 10 a.m. on Thursday and that the president is going to be frog marched out of the White House by 10:15. That's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I'm really interested to read the Mueller report because I'm a Russia guy and I'm really curious about the counterintelligence stuff. I think that those of us who follow Russia and Russian-American relations, we're going to be dissecting this thing for years to come. We're going to be taking it apart for a long time. But people need to lower their expectations about everything because there's two realities with the Mueller report. First of all, as you say, the president's not going to be frog marched out in handcuffs. That's not there. The second reality is it's not going to change a lot of people's minds, even after they read it. It's going to be too complicated. There's going to be a lot of it that's redacted. And I think it's going to tell us stuff that we already know and that the Never Trumpers already know, that the campaign was penetrated and compromised. You know, whether they actively cooperated or not, the Russians were all over this campaign. And the pro-Trump folks, they already know this, and they're not going to care. So right. I don't know that it's going to move the needle that much. It's going to be interesting as hell. It's going to have some serious national security implications and foreign policy implications for the next president. But I think we have to, as you say, you know, sit down, read it. Of course, in the age of social media, telling people to sit down and read something is just crazy talk, but it's worth saying again.
Yeah, and you know, also remembering that we're moving into a different phase here. And, you know, in our editorial, we point out that the roles of the criminal justice system and Congress overlap, but they're distinct. People need to read this not just as a criminal lawyer, but as a citizen, because conduct that doesn't rise to the level of criminal prosecution can still be inconsistent with constitutional standards of conduct. You don't need to be indictable to say this person's unfit for high office. And we've talked about this before. You know, the president may use his sweeping powers in ways that do not technically violate the law, but which constitute an unconstitutional abuse of power. So the president can you know, take actions that are legal, but also impeachable. And this is the thing is that, you know, the remit to the Mueller folks was to determine were criminal statutes violated. Well,
in a very specific instance.
Exactly. In a very specific, relatively narrow way. But now the judgment shifts to Congress and to the American public, which should understand that they play a different role and can apply different standards right to all of this.
I think, you know, as I said today, the Barr summary dropped. What a counterintelligence officer might know to a very high degree of certainty and what a lawyer can prove in a court of law as a specific violation of a criminal statute are two different things. And I think just as the people on the left have been just exhausting about when is Mueller going to just, you know, walk in and arrest the president, which isn't going to happen, the pro-Trump people on the right have been infuriatingly disingenuous because there are people on the right who know better, who know that simply saying that the president was not, that there was no not enough evidence to prove a conspiracy with regard to the 2016 election in this very narrow question that Mueller was asked does not then mean that there was no inappropriate contact with the Russians, no hanky-panky with intelligence officers, no behavior that would fail the smell test or, as you point out, violate the president's constitutional oath. And to simply say, well, Mueller couldn't establish enough evidence to make this one charge, therefore nothing bad ever happened, going all the way back to 1917, is really, as I, you know, again, there are people in our community of conservatives, they know better. They're being openly disingenuous about it.
Okay, so you mentioned, you know, folks on the left who, you know, continue to, you know, raise expectations for all of this. Let's stick with people on the left for a moment. You know, as our category here, Bernie Sanders goes on Fox News. Apparently, did pretty well, but you know, it does seem that the Democrats are convincing themselves that it's going to be okay to run a Democratic socialist. I think that's crazy. I don't think they understand where those votes are at. They almost seem to have gotten the playbook from the Trump White House of, you know, how the Trump White House wants to run this election and going, hey, we can do all that. We're going to rally around Ilhan Omar. We're going to make her the face of the Democratic Party. And we're going to put up this, 95-year-old Democratic Socialist from Vermont. He's not that old. I understand that. So as someone, Mr. Nichols, Professor Nichols, who has argued that we need to vote for Democrats all up and down the ballot, are you getting a little bit of heartburn here watching the Democrats lose? You know what I'm saying here? I mean,
in the words of the immortal Khan in The Wrath of Khan, they task me. they really are exhausting me. Between millionaire socialist Bernie Sanders and, you know, Eric Swalwell promising to arrest you if you don't hand in your guns, it really feels like the Democrats, you know, are, as you say, just following. It's almost like they're writing GOP ads and saving all the GOP consultants the time and energy of having to do it. With that said, I adhere to the notion that this administration is, in fact, an existential crisis of government, that with the exception, people have said to me, you'll vote for any Democrat. Well, the only exception I make is Tulsi Gabbard, who I think is compromised in the same way and is the same kind of danger to the Republic that President Trump is. At some point, you kind of just, you know, do the wash and you let this go and sort it out in 2021. And I've had this argument with conservative colleagues where they say, well, what do you think these policies will look like after a president, you know, Harris or a president Klobuchar or president O'Rourke or whoever it is? And I say, look, we as conservatives, we know how to fight with liberals over policy. What I don't want to keep fighting over is whether there's going to be a constitution next week.
Yeah, at least you understand the awfulness. However, the awfulness of a Democratic Party that has decided that it is socialist. And this is the thing. I was actually on MSNBC, and I was sandwiched between two Democratic consultants who were, of course, you know, doing the party line. And they were discussing whether or not Bernie was electable. And amazingly, they didn't get to me because I was going to go, no, people, you understand who came out and voted for Democrats and gave you control of Congress back in 2018. They were not the raging. They were not the AOCs and the Ilhan Omars. They were not people saying, hey, let's wipe out the private insurance industry. Let's take over the economy, you know, in the name of the Green New Deal. They were not the people pushing for, you know, let's have abortion, you know, right up to, you know, 2 seconds before delivery. That was not or and they were not running in places like Pennsylvania, Michigan and Wisconsin on gun confiscation. This was not this was not what swing voters were saying to all of them. So we had a piece, Sarah Longwell had a piece in the Bulwark the other day saying, you know, trying to warn Democrats, the Democrats right now are in the position that Republicans were in back in 2015. You kind of know that there's this political existential disaster waiting out there. But unless the party gets its act together and consolidates, I do think that Bernie Sanders is going to end up being the nominee, and I think that reelects Donald Trump.
I'm not as concerned about that, in part because, you know, Bernie Sanders is the thing that sounds like a good idea in April, and then, you know, come July or August or even September, you know, people start to sober up and realize realize that you know, that's not a great idea.
I'm having a flashback. See, this is exactly what I used to tell people about Republicans in 2015.
Oh, well, don't that's worry. Also true.
We'll get over it.
But I have two. Something will happen. There are two hopeful signs, and let me just try and put a couple of rays of light on this. One is, in traveling around the country, what reporters are starting to report back, and I saw a few this mentioned a few times, is that the number one issue for Democrats is electability. Which, if that's true, then a lot of these other concerns go away, because you couple that to the second thing that I would say is optimistic, which is Nancy Pelosi. And I can't believe I'm, sitting here saying nice things about Nancy Pelosi. But when she was asked about AOC and the progressive wing, she said, listen, that's like five people. Now, it's a little more than five people, but I think at some point, this is at some point the party, at least I hope, sobers up. On the other hand, I had a visitor today from Czech radio who was asking me, as a foreign correspondent, what do you think about the election? And, how can President Trump be elected? He's in so much having so many issues. And I said, well, this requires the Democrats to be organized and coherent and stop shooting at each other. And I said, and that it is never a good bet to count on that. And I think the irony here is that you and I, looking back to our Republican days, we counted on the Democrats to be this incompetent. We relied on it. I mean, this was how we were winning elections. We, even with weak Republican candidates, you said, don't worry, the Democrats are going to, create their circular firing squad. They're going to move too far to the left. They're going to say all kinds of crazy stuff about guns and abortion that they can't possibly ever put into law. And we're kind of back to that again. I also think the word socialist, I'm hoping that the grown-ups in the Democratic Party kind of reassert themselves and remind people that socialist doesn't mean social or socially cool or sociable, that it means something very specific. I think that will pass, but they need to get over this phase in a hurry and to the business of dealing with Donald Trump.
And I'm sure there are grown-ups, although I'm reading in the New York Times yesterday that one of the grown-ups who's thinking about how to deal this is David Brooks. So when David Brooks is the, did you see, okay, so I want to go to this argument that I see the same numbers. The Democrats say that they are all about electability, but there's also this impulse. And we saw this in the Republican side as well, where one of your guys says something that is intemperate, extreme, offensive, and then there's this overwhelming pressure to defend that person no matter what. It's almost knee-jerk. You must do it. And you're seeing this right now among Democrats, where all of the passion, at least over the last 48, 72 hours, is we must defend Ilhan Omar, one of the most notorious anti-Semites ever to serve in Congress, someone whose rhetoric is so reckless. And of course, the president puts out this deeply offensive, deeply demagogic and manipulative and divisive. How many words can I string together here?
Dangerous.
Dangerous tweet about her linking, showing the trauma of the collapse of the towers on September 11th. David Frum, though, makes a point that, yes, as outrageous as Trump's tweet was, his mission was accomplished here. Trump, in this way, what he writes, Trump wishes to make Omar the face of the Democratic Party heading into the 2020 elections, and now he has provoked Democrats to comply. Yes. Democrats are now stuck with responsibility for the reckless things the representative of Minnesota says, not only about Jews, but about other issues too. After Trump's tweeted attack, Omar will become even more internally uncriticizable and unmanageable without becoming any more careful or responsible. And I'm going, oh, man. And of course, behind that, of course, is that every Democratic candidate for president has now put out some statements, some very glowing statements, basically expressing their solidarity with her. They didn't have to in a rational world, but in this world of absolute tribal loyalties and litmus tests, one Democrat after another feels the need to suddenly now, because Trump is attacking her, we're going to embrace her. And it's like, are you kidding me?
Right. I mean, Trump on this, Donald Trump is probably the least intelligent person, least informed person probably ever to hold the Oval Office. But he has flashes of genius like this, where he knows
lizard brain. Yeah.
Yes, his lizard brain is extremely cunning. And he knows that putting out this incredibly offensive video is exactly going to make the Democrats rally. And instead, I mean, Ilhan Omar is just waiting for some Democrat to have a sister soldier moment here, that the first Democrat who breaks from the pack and says, you know, enough of this, is going to have a lot of credibility, because you're right. There's no doubt about it. I mean, no matter how many times you watch that clip, I mean, she really is very dismissive about, you know, some people did something. Her anti-Semitic statements, you know, are on the record. They're not deniable. And yet Democrats feel the need to flock to her because they are still, you know, in this victim mentality. The other thing that strikes me about the Democratic Party, and one of the things that makes me somewhat nostalgic for the old days of the Democratic Party, is both with her and AOC, when did the Democratic Party become this organization that tolerates a couple of freshmen, you know, basically seizing the public face of the party and raising hell and causing all these problems for Democrats all across the country? I mean, I think Nancy Pelosi is doing kind of a remarkable job here of balancing this and not getting sucked in and baited into defending Omar. But it does kind of make you wish for a Tip O'Neill or a Jim Wright, you know, having that quiet talk of saying, hey, it's your first year here, you know, you don't have a right to burn down the whole party just because you're having a good time and you have a social media account. So again, you know, will it happen? I don't know, but I'm looking forward to the first Democrat who raises their hand and says, wait a minute, you know, I'm not going to the wall, you know, for socialism or for anti-Semitism or for any of these ideas, which I don't think really do represent the mainstream of the Democratic Party. If I really did, I would withdraw my whole comment about supporting the Democrats.
Okay, because I'm sensing the sort of the immune system is breaking down. By the way, do you remember Congressman Cynthia McKinney? She was the last time that you had a sort of an overtly anti-Israel, anti-Semitic member of Congress, and yet somehow she never became the face of the National Democratic Party. The Democrats actually had figured out a way not to make her this superstar. And I understand there are people who say that it is the Republicans and Fox News, et cetera, who are obsessed with AOC and who are obsessed with Ilhan Omar. But, you know, David French makes the point, you know, it was not conservatives that put her on the cover of Vanity Fair or features her on Rolling Stone. Stone, or, you know, devotes one segment after another, you know, on the Chris Hayes show to her. They have elevated her. I have a piece up on the Bulwark today, basically bad faith all the way around, whether or not, you know, you should, you know, give her any benefit of the doubt. And it's like my take on this is that everybody involved in this, you know, pox on all their houses. Everybody's irresponsible.
But, you know, the Democrats are also the people who are defending Omar and AOC and saying, well, you know, Fox News is going to demonize them no matter what they say. That's a disingenuous answer, because one of the reasons they are beloved to Fox News and to the GOP is because they provide a steady stream of workable material that is heaven sent for Fox and for the GOP. I mean, you don't see Fox trying to figure out how to warp, you know, Conor Lamb, you know, because Conor Lamb doesn't put out crazy statements. I mean, these are young people who are inexperienced in politics. And frankly, in the case of AOC, seems to be having the time of her life after, I think, pretty much what constituted an accidental election where they took out what could have been the next Speaker of the House among the Democrats. You know, this notion that, well, it's just because of Fox is ridiculous. If you feed the beast, you feed the beast. They are a source of, I think David French was the one, as you point out, who made the point that it's one thing to say, you know, they would take their statements and make hay with them. It's another thing if they keep making statements that are so easily used.
Yeah, I know.
And
no.
So awful,
and they're perfectly designed for talk radio. The answer to the trivia question that I'm about to ask you is 27 years. 27 years, Dr. Nichols.
I think that 27 years ago, the Peloponnesian War.
It may have. Well, that's interesting. It was because you made a reference that you and I understand, but I'm thinking because I've reached an age where I realize that almost all the historical analogies that I make, you know, are responded to with blank, you know, blank stares. The Sister Soldier moment was 27 years ago.
Wow.
So I know we have among the most brilliant listeners, the most informed people in American politics who are listening
old,
to us
Charlie.
Right now. But It was 27 years ago. People understand what the Sister Soldier moment was. And this is the summer of 1992. Bill Clinton is running for president. There was a rap singer named Sister Soldier who had been making remarks about, you know, blacks should, you know, kill whites instead of each other. And Bill Clinton goes to an event, and I think Jesse Jackson was there, and he denounces her. And yeah. It was a calculated denunciation of this extreme position, and with some political risk. And it really became this defining moment for Bill Clinton as a centrist of the time, and it did not derail him. Now,
no, and it, it didn't blow up in his face.
It did not. Now, here's my question, though, because I'm more skeptical about this. I think that now, you know, 27 years later, if a Democrat tried to pull off a Sister Soldier moment, a, you know, Ilhan Omar moment like that, he or she would be eaten alive by the Twitter mobs, by the social justice warriors. They wouldn't make it out of the room.
Yeah, I think that would probably happen on social media. But as I think it was Nate Silver wrote a piece the other day pointing out that Democratic voters are largely not on social media, and that most voters are not on social media. You're right that it, you know, there would be a Twitter mob forming, but I also think it depends on how it was said and what provokes it, because, you know, this is not the last thing Ilhan Omar is going to say. I mean, I think part of the reason people have rushed to her defense is they say, okay, you know, we're going to kind of go, it's kind of the way people have done with Trump, right? Where they say, you know, we'll go to the wall for him. This is the last time he's learned his lesson. It won't happen again. And then as they've learned with Trump, you know, every 10 minutes, it gets worse. This is not going to be the last time Ilhan Omar is going to say something bad. You can count on it. You can make bank
absolutely
on it. And so, you know, at some point, I think there is going to be room for a Democrat to say, listen, I thought I defended her against unfair attacks. I get it that she's new. People new in politics make mistakes, but enough's enough. And I think that there's an opportunity. Now, whether that will happen, I don't know. But I think there's a lot of room for a Democrat there to do something like that.
Yeah, the opportunity cost for that has just gone up, I think, substantially.
I think among young voters, that's true, just as going after Bernie. Although, again, at some point, some Democrat is going to have to step forward and say, you know, this guy is basically doing Donald Trump's work for him against the Democratic Party. And it's going to annoy, you know, Bernie supporters. But I think Democrats have to ask themselves, you know, do we take seriously the notion that Donald Trump is an existential threat? Because they're not acting like it right now. And this is where, as a never-Trumper who has wished them all the best and hopes they win, that's what really grinds my gears, is I've said Donald Trump is an existential threat. I'm going to act like he's an existential threat. I'm going to vote Democrat, even though it goes against, you know, most of the bones in my body. But I need Democrats to be just as serious about this and to say
Democrats
he really
not
is
to be
an existential
crazy. Yeah.
threat.
You need them not to be crazy. You need them to be crazy. And by the way, you know, I do think, though, the real danger here, of course, is that after, you know, being numbed by 4 years of Donald Trump, people might say, okay, he's awful, but he's a known evil, as opposed to the unknown evil of a democratic socialist. Now, I happen to think, and I think you probably think the same thing, that a second term of Donald Trump will be substantially worse than the first term, especially if he feels absolutely emboldened and unchained, and all of the norms have been shattered, so that you think it's bad, it will be worse. But on the other hand, you know, let's be honest about it. Most people are going to be making these decisions based on the economy, their jobs, their 401ks, and the more they hear about Bernie Sanders' ideas, I think the more alarmed they're going to be. Okay, so since we're on this topic, also yesterday, Bill Weld jumped into the race. He's the first guy in. He's testing the water. Obviously, you know, in some ways, maybe he's a placeholder to test whether or not Donald Trump is vulnerable. I think a lot of us would like to see stronger candidates, but it is interesting that Weld is a former governor of Massachusetts, got a rather sketchy party history. He was, you know, he voted for Barack Obama, ran on the Libertarian ticket. But he's not a complete flake.
No, but, you know, I still would argue that of all the people to challenge Trump, this was really a bad idea, because, you know, Trump's whole thing is to argue. I mean, let's face it, the new realignment in American politics is not left versus right or conservative versus Republican. This is a cultural schism between people who feel like the world is run by Ivy educated elites and real Americans who, you know, work hard and bale hay and drive trucks and, you know, all of that. You know, these like truck commercial images. Bill Weld, unfortunately, I think, will play right into the stereotype of the only Republican willing to step up against Donald Trump is an effete Massachusetts governor who's, you know, pro-choice, who's pro-drug legalization, who ran, you know, as God help us, Gary Johnson's vice president.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many ways that that Trump can say, this proves that my Republican opponents and the Democrats are basically the same people. And that's what concerns me.
Yeah, I take your point. On the other hand, I do think that when you look at these polls showing that even though, I mean, there's one set of polls that shows that Donald Trump has 89% approval rating among Republicans, which no Republican president has ever known, which would suggest that he is totally invulnerable. But then you look at these other numbers showing that 40% of the Republican electorate is open to the idea of a primary challenger. So the question is, does Weld become that placeholder and, you know, perform the function that, say, that Eugene McCarthy did back in 1968, reaching back into history? He didn't win in New Hampshire, but he did well enough to convince Bobby Kennedy to belatedly get into that race and ultimately caused Lyndon Johnson to jump out.
But who's the Republican Bobby Kennedy, Charlie? If Weld kicks that door open and says within the Republican Party, it's OK to challenge Donald Trump, and he manages to in any way dent Donald Trump, which, again, you know, the first thing Donald Trump's going to say is Bill Weld, Massachusetts, Harvard College, Oxford, JD from Harvard, you know, Harvard. And because remember, when you go to a good school, it only matters if you're Donald Trump. Everybody else who goes to a good school.
I thought you liked elite schools. Well, I thought you were the guy.
Only if he went. That's because, you know, again, it's only good if Donald Trump does it. And so even if Weld manages to do that, who's the guy? I mean, the Republicans need, a Ben Sasse or a Republican version of a Sherrod Brown or somebody who has a much more common touch who is also a Republican. And I think the current Republican Party, which, of course, as you know, and those of us who follow, you know, Republican Party politics know, the GOP has already erected obstacles to any kind of primary challenge.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, who's going to be the guy who says, I'm going to commit harakiri by going up against Donald Trump? And it would have to be somebody who's not running for reelection, somebody who's done with their time as a governor or a senator, and somebody who's really willing to pull out all the stops and throw really hard punches. And I just don't think it's Weld. I mean, I think he's a good guy. I just don't think it's him.
In terms of non-Trump Republicans, I mean, you get a sense that the party has been sort of decapitated because there is no Bobby Kennedy-like figure out there. It's not going to be Jeb Bush who's going to be jumping in here. Look at that Republican field that ran in the primaries in 2016. There's not one of them who would jump into the race with the possible exception of John Kasich, and I don't think that he has that, you know, particular role. By the way, when you're talking about this elitist issue, and I'm probably going to regret going this direction, but I was thinking about this. Because it was actually an emotionally powerful and I thought really interesting exchange on the Rachel Maddow show with Pete Buttigieg, where he's talking about, you know, coming out of the closet. And did you hear this exchange?
No.
It was a rather remarkable moment. Okay, so Rachel Maddow is describing how she was the first ever openly gay Rhodes Scholar. Oh. And how difficult it was. Okay, she's a Rhodes Scholar who becomes openly gay. And Pete Buttigieg becomes a Rhodes Scholar later, but does not come out. And in fact, doesn't come out until his 30s. And she was asking, you know, why didn't you come out till a little bit later? And it was interesting. He talked about, you know, struggling with, you know, his sexuality. And it was very, very personal. And it was the kind of, you know, personal confession that you rarely hear, you know, when he talks about all of that. And I'm thinking, this is not a conversation that is going to connect
No.
With the swing voters in the election.
Did you come out before or after you were a Rhodes Scholar?
Well, that was the discussion. These two Rhodes Scholars talking about their gayness. Now, again, I don't have a problem with his gayness. I really am fascinated by him. I think he's by far the most interesting candidate. But you're starting to see that there is that sort of elite discussion that Democrats get prone to, where they think that let's sit around and share stories of our wokeness.
When we were
at Oxford, and then we'll talk about how we are going to get those blue collar workers from Wisconsin and Michigan back into the fold.
And in a way, that's unfair to Pete Buttigieg, because
it's very unfair. Yeah,
you know, if I have one concern about Pete Buttigieg, it's that he's too young.
Yeah.
I mean, I keep looking at Buttigieg and I'm saying, a couple of terms in Congress, maybe a term as a senator or a governor, very credible president. Maybe a credible vice president right now. But yeah, it doesn't really help his case or anything the Democratic Party. You know, again, that's the Rachel Maddow show speaking to the already converted. And the last thing you need is a long conversation about, you know, did we come to terms with our gayness before or after we were Rhodes Scholars? That's almost like a Saturday Night Live conversation.
Then you saw, I'm presuming you saw on Twitter, this very, very impressive moment where Pete Buttigieg is reacting to the fire at Notre Dame by talking to a French television station and speaking
in French
and apparently pretty good French.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, because I've read The Death of Expertise, I'm thinking this is fantastic. This is the kind of person we want. But actually, my lizard brain is saying he's effed.
Well, you know, somebody asked me about this a while back. I was talking with Tara McKelvey at the BBC, and she said, you know, what is it about French? You know, because speaking Norwegian, everybody thought that was cool.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, French, it's the one language. It's like the John Kerry problem, right?
Yeah.
That you can speak. Nobody's ever called me effete because I can speak Russian.
Right.
Nobody, you know, criticizes Pete Buttigieg for being able to speak Norwegian. But there is something about speaking good French that immediately kind of, you know, pops up a flag.
Which is stupid. Come on.
Is stupid, but it's also the reality of politics.
I remember Rush Limbaugh constantly referring to the French-speaking John Kerry as if that was an insult. Look, my grandkids are French. My daughter lives in France. So I don't have that prejudice, but I do know this. And it's just that if you want to continue to dumb down our politics, and that's what makes this fascinating as a moment, because, you know, Pete Buttigieg, he is perhaps too young. He is so much the anti-Trump in the sense of his thoughtfulness, his decency, his
grace,
his in grace and his intelligence. You know, to actually have someone, you know, there's part of me that also just cringes at the thought that you're going to have this, you know, Rhodes Scholar who speaks seven languages, fundamentally decent human being, up against Donald Trump. And America will choose Donald Trump. And I just don't want to live through that.
You know, and people being upset, you know, because of the way he eats a corn dog, you know, in the classic, you know, state fair moment. I think being from Indiana, you know, that I think will insulate Buttigieg from some of that. But I think you're pointing at a much bigger problem here, which is that people want a vulgarian.
They
almost want somebody who just, because I think they've gotten to the point of saying, I want someone who would act the way I would.
Okay.
You know, we always say this about Trump, right? People like Trump because he's what they would be if he had their money, or if they had his money. And I think the same problem emerges here of, I want someone who would act the way I act, who, you know, insults the French while Notre Dame is burning. I mean, that was a terrific moment, you know, offering
advice. That was a great moment. So you're thinking that people are sitting out there in rural America and saying, you know, I actually like a guy who would think that you throw water balloons at the burning cathedral, you know, that you use water bombs. That's the kind
Trump
of cool
is the guy who sits at the end of the bar spouting off, you know, all day long, and they love that guy.
You know, there ought to be a rule. I saw this somewhere on social media, which, you know, I might as well confess, because I should be reading books, right? You know, I should tell you that I'm reading books. But somebody said, you know, there ought to be like a rule of thumb that the stupidest person in America should not also be the president of the United States. I mean, there ought to be like some separation of power here. So I'm guessing that this is consistent with your theory about the death of expertise. When the president of the United States, as one of the world's great Landmarks is burning, tweets out his idea to what, drop water from airplanes on it?
To do the one thing that would destroy the entire. And in fact, it was interesting that the French emergency services, all of their tweets were in French, except for one, which was in English, to say, you know, without referring to Trump directly, saying you can't water bomb the building. It would, you know, you can't pour 300 million gallons of hot water on, or cold water on hot stone. And, you know, but they did it in English very much as a, you know, please, Mr. President, you know, you're unpopular here enough. Please don't tell us how to destroy what's left of Notre Dame. And I think, you know, but it was perfectly on brand for Donald Trump, because millions of people probably sat around saying, see, he's a problem solver. He fixes things.
Yeah.
The stupid French are running around while their cathedral burns, but Donald Trump knows what to do. And they really believe it. I mean, this is just part of the Donald Trump reality show that I have just come to accept, that 35 to 40% of the American public just believe it. Anytime he says something.
Well, I actually had a bad moment when I was looking at some of the tweets. Of course, as you know, because we live in this modern era, where there were some really malevolent trolls out there who were suggesting putting out fake tweets that implied this was Islamic terrorists, and then of course you begin to have that speculation in the fever swamps of the right, including Glenn Beck, who's apparently having some sort of an acid flashback to his old self about this, and Kurt Schlichter, who took a break from writing, you know, white nationalist violence porn, you know, kill the libs to own them or whatever, to suggest that, well, what if it was Islamic terrorists? Would we ever really know? Can you really trust the deep state? And it did occur to me that if Donald Trump, in one of his moments, were ever to say, well, how do we know that this wasn't an act of terrorism? That 35 to 40% of Americans would go, yeah, how do we really know? It would just be like
that's,
that.
That's his brand. And that's also his strategy. Because, you know, the other day when Sarah Huckabee Sanders said, well, the president shouldn't release his tax reports because, you know, it's thousands of pages and nobody in Congress would understand it. They say these things because they know it works, because there are millions of rubes who will look at each other and say, yeah, how would they be able to know? I mean, it's not like Congress has accountants or tax experts or economists or anybody who could look at these things. He says these things knowing that they just go straight into the top line kind of id of his listeners. And the people floating these Muslim terrorism theories, I mean, this is really, you know, as you say, people like Schlichter, you know, writing second Civil War porn, it's almost like they're disappointed if they find out that this was just, you know, a fire that happened because of a renovation. They're looking for this violence.
We may lose one of the most important landmarks in Western civilization, but we didn't get our narrative. By the way, there was a very interesting, I wish I knew who this guy was who was tweeting about all of this, because it was this notion that the French didn't know what they were doing. They really did. I mean, the fire department, there's a tweet here. The fire department in Paris followed a protocol: save the people, save the art, save the altar, save what furniture you can, then focus on the structure. They know what can be rebuilt and what can't. This protocol has been in place since the last time the cathedral was destroyed, sacked during the French Revolution. This is amazing. The steeple and the beams supporting it are 160 years old, and oaks for new beams await at Versailles. They'd actually know that they needed to grow trees in case this actually ever happened. But a lot of foolish commentary. Just talk about this for a moment.
And actually, Notre Dame's in pretty good shape today, considering what just happened. I mean, the walls are intact.
Unbelievable.
Apparently, all the stained glass except for one window has survived. I mean, there will be a Notre Dame cathedral for future generations, much to the disappointment of people who were hoping, you know, and let's add in Mark Stein and others who were jumping on this, much to the disappointment of people who were hoping that this was, you know, the beginning of the great European conflagration. I mean, it really is. It has gotten disgusting the way people, as you say, you know, have to just impose the narrative at every moment, because I think deep down they're really concerned that it's all slipping away from them at this point.
You use phrase like you use the term existential threat a little bit earlier in political terms, but you know what I think really shakes you or shook me about watching Notre Dame go down. And I've been there, and is this a reminder of the fragility of civilization?
Yes.
We just assume that things that have been around for 100 years will always be here, but the essence of a lot of civilization is the fact that it's fragile and incredibly detailed and utterly and completely irreplaceable. Now, I was thinking about this and I was going to bounce this off you. You know, we are a young country. We don't have institutions like this that are 900 years old, that are so bound up with the national identity. I was trying to think what the equivalent disaster would be in this country that would shock us. Obviously, we saw the Twin Towers come down, but this is different. The only thing I could come up with would be like, you know, watching the Capitol on fire and the Capitol dome collapsing, because we don't have anything that is quite as just like as so iconic to French culture as this one building.
Or maybe a fire at the National Archives that claims the last written version of the Constitution.
Oh, yeah.
National Archive and the Bill of Rights and everything that were in it, the irreplaceable heritage that we count on. And, you know, you're right, Charlie. The thing about the fire at Notre Dame that I found so unsettling is not just that we count on these landmarks. I mean, I feel like as a person, as a member of Western civilization, I count on it that Notre Dame is just there. You know, I even said to somebody on Twitter the other day, no matter what I may think about the Russian regime, I count on it that the Kremlin exists. I mean, the Kremlin has been there, you know, since time immemorial. If something were to happen to it, I would find that shocking. But what really bothers me is how many people live around us now in Western civilization who don't care. Mm-hmm. Who would be happy to see the steeple of Notre Dame fall if it would trigger the libs and mm-hmm. spark a conflict. And I think that's the thing. You know, there once was a time where no matter how much we disagreed with each other about things, we understood that we all shared in a common heritage of Western civilization and of mankind itself. And now everything has just become a transactional and disposable instrument for furthering our kind of petty grievances about politics, and particularly from people, again, who have decided that, you know, they are the downtrodden, disrespected cultural minority who will do anything to kind of get even with people who think Notre Dame is a treasure. And that's what really scares me.
I want to push back a little bit, because the Kirchlichters of the world are not representative of much outside of the swamp. And I am moved by watching the way the French, who are as bitterly divided as they've been they're used to being bitterly divided, the way they have come together and this outpouring of support and the money that's coming forward to rebuilding. And so they're having that one of those moments of grace and unity that we experienced so briefly after 9/11.
Well, maybe
at least there's that positive, you know.
Maybe I'm concerned about the reaction from conservatives, especially.
Yeah, I know.
Because I think
the Trumpian conservatives. Exactly.
And because conservatives have always prided themselves on tradition, on history, on the landmarks of civilization. And which isn't to say the progressives don't respect those things, but that I think we as conservatives, part of our thing is this stronger attachment to history, maybe even an overly unhealthy attachment to history and a resistance to change at times. But to see people, you know, that you really would have wanted to see better from on the right, kind of, you know, pushing these narratives and kind of applauding the president's dumb remarks. And I mean, it just feels like we're losing some kind of connection to those touchstones of civilization. And I find it really disturbing.
Right.
I find it, there's almost a kind of, you know, again, kind of willing intentional vulgarianism involved in it that I think is
very,
really
very
scary.
Much. It's a cultivated vulgarianism, you know, this fake populism, which again, Notre Dame represents what we used to understand civilization was, which was, quite frankly, an elite phenomenon that we all understood and that we drew our power and our meaning from. Tom Nichols, thanks again so much for spending time with me. I appreciate it very much.
Always great to be with you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.